something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone. A comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone. A comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars, and clowns. Old situations, new complications. Nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight.
A list of the great lyricists of American musical theater is guaranteed to include Frank Lesser, Cole Porter, Dorothy Fields, probably Oscar Hammerstein, Irving Berlin, Lorenz Hart, most definitely my next guest, Stephen Sondheim, who has worked on some of Broadway's most beloved shows, including Gypsy, West Side Story, A Funny Thing Happened on the way to the Forum, Company, Follies, Sunday in the Park with George. He's won 7 Tonys, 7 Grammys, an Oscar, and the Pulitzer Prize, along with receiving many other honors, including the Kennedy Center honors. And now he has written Finishing the Hat, Collected Lyrics, 1954-1981, with attendant comments, principles, heresies, grudges, whines, and anecdotes. In it, he shares his approach to writing lyrics and some of the stories from the shows that have made him famous. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Stephen Sondheim to our show today. Hello.
Hello there.
Now, you wrote comedy tonight for A Funny Thing Happened on the way to the Forum, and you say it may be the best opening number ever put on the stage?
Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about the song. I'm talking about Jerry Robbins' work on it. Because the song is, as Jerry requested, just a canvas for him to work from. He said, please, Steve, don't tell any jokes. I wrote this out of town when Jerry came in to save the show. We were in dire trouble in Washington. And
he said, don't write any jokes?
Yeah.
But you did.
Well, not really, not in the song. Mm-hmm. There aren't really any jokes in that song. There are a couple of puns, mm-hmm. but there aren't any jokes in the song. There's nothing to laugh at, really, in the song. And as Jerry said, you know, we have to have an opening number. You have to have an opening number that will tell the audience what kind of show this is. Namely, it's low comedy, but an elegant low comedy. And prepared, then he said, and just don't do any jokes in the song. Just let me do the jokes. And that's exactly what he did. And the staging was, as anybody who ever saw it, memorable. I mean, it was incredible. It was funny. It was wildly inventive. It was surreal. And it set up Zero Mostel as the star of the evening. And the music is a sort of a tabula rasa is all it is. I mean, when I say the music, the song, you know, it's not very interesting a song. It's jolly and it's you know, you tap your foot to it, but it's the right
tone.
Remember
the melody also.
Yeah.
But have you followed that advice ever since?
No.
Setting the tone?
Number? If Jerry Robbins was ever to come and work, say, I want to stay and tell me not to do jokes, I would do it. No. Generally an opening number is the kind of thing where you want to grab the audience's attention with what you're saying because you're going to tell them what the evening's going to be about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But no, and certainly other numbers of other shows I worked on have been virtually as pretty. I mean, Michael Bennett's staging of the opening of Company was, again, memorable. And I've seen certainly other shows, Jerry's opening of Fiddler on the Roof. You know, the opening number is the most important moment in any musical, and because it tells the audience everything, including whether they're going to like the show or not.
Well, it follows the overture, which also
we don't have overtures anymore. You're dealing with your generation and my generation. We used to have overtures; they don't occur anymore.
Why did you decide to put together a volume of your lyrics now, and only the ones that you wrote before 1981? Was 1981 a particularly significant year?
No. It's the first of two volumes, and because it was going to be so long, I suggested to Knopf, the publisher, that maybe it should be in two volumes because, as I said, if it was in one volume, only Olympic shot putters would be able to handle it.
It is big.
So 1981 is – first of all, it's a demarking place for many reasons. It was the end of my a string of collaborations with Hal Prince. It was my meeting with James Lapine, which was a whole new phase of my writing life and – doing it in off-Broadway theater, and Sunday in the Park with George was the first show I wrote with him, and we did that off-Broadway. And so it just seemed like a very good place to stop. Although and it's about half the stuff.
Although you did work with Hal Prince again on Wise Guys.
Yeah, I said the uninterrupted, the string. Yeah.
But it's interesting. You mentioned Sunday in the Park with George. You took your title from a song in that play, even though that was written after 1981.
That often happens. For the book, you mean, Finishing the Hat, yeah. Well, that's because when I first thought of it, I thought of it as one volume. I was just going to do all the shows. But it was a title that the publishers liked a lot. And I said, well, then I'll have to put in a little explanation. And actually, they have put in an explanation on the cover, on the little cover material on the right-hand cover. And it explains to the reader who might not know that it comes from a song that's going to be in Volume 2.
And according to reports, Volume 2 is going to be called Look, I Made a Hat.
Yes, that's another line from the song.
You say that you enjoy composing more than writing lyrics, but in the early part of your career, you were known primarily as a lyricist. Were you, like Frank Lesser, feeling frustrated because you wanted to write the music as well?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I was trained as a composer. I majored in music. And it sounds kind of condescending. I'd actually written a musical called Saturday Night, which the producer of which died while we were raising the money. We'd raised about half the money for the show. And he died, and the rights passed to his widow, who was not a producer in any way, shape, or form. And so the whole thing sort of fell apart. And eventually the show got produced many, 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 many years later.
But it must have made things easier that your early collaborators were musical giants, Leonard Bernstein, Julie Stein, Richard Rodgers.
Easy for what? I mean, first of all, if you're talking about the first job was with Leonard Bernstein, but I had to audition for that with the music from Saturday Night. So that's how I got that job, was auditioning that. And I really just wanted to meet Lenny. I didn't particularly want to do the show. With Oscar Hammerstein, who was my surrogate father and mentor, who said it would be frustrating as it would be not to write music, I would learn a great deal, and it sounded like a good show. And I must say it sounded like a really interesting show, but I really just wanted to meet Leonard Bernstein.
But did you learn? I mean, we're talking about some great musicals coming out of these collaborations.
No. I learned from everybody I worked with. I learned from Lenny. I learned from Arthur. I learned from Jerry, all different things. And I even learned from Julie on Gypsy. Yeah, sure. Well, first of all those experiences are learning experiences, but these are particularly articulate men with very opinionated outlooks, which is the way you learn, is people who are very opinionated.
And also dealing, maybe even arguing with them.
Yeah, well, absolutely, sure. And I, West Side Story, I gathered enough strength by the time I was through with West Side Story so that when I went into Gypsy, I really, you know, I was only 25 years old with West Side, and not only with all these very accomplished men, my collaborators, but they were all, particularly Arthur and Jerry, were very overbearing kinds of collaborators. And Lenny was too, as a matter of fact, in his own way. So, you know, I didn't open my mouth a lot. I did, but I mean, I didn't. I didn't argue vociferously until we'd been working for like a year and a half.
Well, you studied with Milton Babbitt,
right? Indeed.
Would you say he was more of an influence than
Bernstein? He certainly taught me a lot. And Lenny was impressed that I'd study with Milton. Milton was an atonal and already an electronic composer in the days before anybody else even knew what electronic music was. And Lenny was impressed and suspicious at the same time. He was afraid that I was going to start arguing that the music should be atonal.
every song in a 12-tone row. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a great opera, the Wozzeck, pulls that off.
It certainly is. Wozzeck, incidentally, as Milton would be happy to tell you, is not strictly 12-tone.
He cheated.
He cheated, and just as well. I think Milton told me it was in the key of G. I don't remember, but he told me it was in. I said, "Well, if that's the key of whatever it is, I'm surprised." But and Lenny eventually started use 12-tone rows. There's a 12-tone row in West Side Story.
Really?
Yes. The cool fugue. Listen to the accompaniment when they start dancing. Mm-hmm. It's a 12-tone row in three groups of four. Yeah, listen to it.
Well, you could sneak, I guess, movie music has been sneaking that kind of stuff in ever since Schoenberg was alive.
Absolutely correct.
Now, do you think you'll ever put out a book on the craft of composing?
Music's so hard to talk about without using technical terms, and therefore, for a general readership, I think probably not. I think it has to be entirely for musicians if one is really going to write about how to write music or how to write a song or what constitutes a melodic. Whatever.
My guest is Stephen Sondheim, who has put together a book, first of two volumes on writing lyrics. It's called Finishing the Hat, Collected Lyrics 1954 to 1981. In your estimation, what makes a lyric good? Is it being clever, having good rhymes, internal rhymes, triple rhymes, things like that?
No, that makes perhaps for a clever lyric. No, a good lyric, you know, what makes a good sentence? What makes a good paragraph? You're telling a story, and if the lyric is serving the story and is consistent with the character and has its own delights, meaning surprises, either verbal surprises or thought surprises, or and has a continuity and has something to say, everything that a short story should have, or everything that a novel should have.
But not always requiring a rhyme.
There are times to rhyme and times not to.
Irving Berlin was, I heard, was going around really worried because he couldn't come up with a good ending to Always. He wanted a rhyme, and he told somebody of what he had, and he said, well, that's perfect. I don't know if you think.
Well, which rhyme are you talking
not
about?
Not for just an hour, not just for day, not for just a year, but always.
But that doesn't rhyme always.
No, I know. He wanted a rhyme, and then they said, well, Irving, that's fine the way it is.
There's a famous parody of that song, and my memory is such at this age that I can't regurgitate it to you exactly, but it does. I'll be loving you always. With a love as heavy as with a love as grand as Paul Whiteman's band, and my love will be as bad as Paulways. It would be as heavy as Paulways, and then also the hallways, which is the obvious rhyme for it. But I like
there aren't too many rhymes for hallways.
Heavy is not the word, but as Paulways is really fun.
You write that songwriters are halfway between creator and interpreter. Is that because they have to keep the connection to the book and to the plot?
No, it's just that. The only begetter is the book writer. That's the person who makes it up out of nothing. There are two kinds of art, obviously. There's creative art and interpretive art when you deal with things like the theater or symphonies and things like that. You have the person who writes it and then the person who performs it. The songwriter does both. The songwriter does not make it up out of nothing. The songwriter makes it up out of the characters and the situations that the book writer has made. But he's also he's partly creative in that he is also making a song where there wasn't a song before, but he is interpreting at the same time. He's interpreting the playwrights.
Is this why most poets are not very good lyricists?
No, I think most poets, I think there are numerous reasons. Poetry and lyrics have really nothing to do with each other. Poetry is, as I think I say in the book, the art of concision. The whole idea of poetry is to compress images and ideas so that they resonate with each other. And a poem has to be read at its own speed by the reader. I think poetry should be read aloud, but everybody reads at a different rhythm. And also with poetry, if you don't understand, as quite often one doesn't on the first reading of a poem, you can go back over it. But in lyrics exist in time, and they need exactly the reverse of concision. They have to be concise but have plenty of air and leave room for the music to do its work, because lyrics do not exist by themselves. They exist in conjunction with and in necessary conjunction with music. Poets tend to ignore that. They know that music is going to, that their lyric is going to be set on music, or the music is going to be set to the lyric, but they don't really allow for it. They poets who write lyrics write too poetically, and it's difficult for the ear, the audience's ear, to take in. It's too rich. Some of Truman Capote's lyrics in House of Flowers, because he was a poet. Certainly in opera, when you look at Auden and Kallman's libretto for Rake's Progress, apart from the fact that Stravinsky screws around with the syllables anyway and does melismas that break the words apart, it's on paper, you understand what you're reading. On the stage, you don't.
Any number of poets, I think Mark Strand most recently told me that he doesn't necessarily like it when people set his poems to music.
No, I don't think poems should be set to music. I mean, when I say should, I mean, I don't think I've ever heard a poem set to music that improved the poem.
Now, we're going to go to a little break. We're going to play Let Me Entertain You. Should I ask you about that? Or maybe we'll come back with a little talk about Let Me Entertain You. Well, it was some people would argue that Gypsy is a perfect musical. What about Let Me Entertain You, it appears twice in the show.
Yes, that's the idea. The idea is I had to find something for the kids to sing at the beginning of the show that could then be adapted for Louise when she's grown up and is doing her first strip to sing. It had to be the same lyric, but it had to be able to have a double entendre meaning.
And you knew that from the start while you were writing it?
Oh, sure. Sure. Well, we plotted the whole piece first. Before it was, you don't just write blind. I mean, we knew that it was going to start with the kids doing their vaudeville act, and we knew that it was going to climax with one of them becoming the striptease artist that she became. And so knowing that, it seemed to me that it would be very useful to have a song, because Arthur may even have thought of it. I don't remember who thought of it. The idea that Rose, in her haste to make Louise a stripper, would have to rummage through old songs of the act until she could find one that her daughter could sing. So I had to do that. And then I kept putting it off and putting off and writing all the other songs because nothing came to mind. And I finally was having a conversation with Jerry Robbins about it, who directed the piece. And he said, I said, I don't know exactly what to say. He said, let me entertain you. And he just said it impatiently. And I said, Jerry, guess what? You just solved it all with one phrase.
And we'll see how effective it was.
Let me entertain you. Let me see you smile. I will do some kicks. I will do some tricks.
Sing out, Louise.
I'll tell you a story. I'll dance
and cheat. Catch up.
By the time we're through entertaining you,
there sits a boat, gently dipping its bow. Trim and tidy and built to float. Pretty little picture. Now, put a boy on the starboard side, leaning out at the rail. Next to him, put a blushing bride, slim and slender and starry-eyed. Down below, put a tiny bed. The sun gets pale, the sea gets red, and off they sail on the first high tide. The boat and the bed and the boy and the bride. It's a pretty little picture. Oh, my pretty little picture. How true, pretty little picture. Which I soon a little less give to you. Feel the roll of the playful waves. See the sails as they swell.
We're back with Stephen Sondheim, who has written a book called Finishing the Hat, collected lyrics 1954-1981 with attendant comments, principles, heresies, grudges, whines, and anecdotes. And we'll get to those in just a few moments. You share your rules for good lyrics. Content dictates form, less is more, God is in the details and clarity. Well, how would that apply to the song we just heard, Pretty Little Picture, from Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum?
Well, unfortunately, the last section, The Sand of the Sea and the Stars, that section gets the clarity is not as clear as it should be. But the first part of it, the first couple of, first half of it anyway, maybe the first two-thirds, are pretty clear, and certainly this is not a case of less is more, since it's rather verbose, but then the idea of the lyric is a playful lyric, and it's to play with words. And it's Pseudolus is enticing the two young lovers to run away, and so it has Pseudolus's sort of glib, silver-tongued approach to, because he's the prototypical conniver and con man. And so that required, it seemed to me, a lot of words, which that's like a medicine man, like a, you know, man in a medicine show.
Your lyrics can be incredibly nimble and witty. Is there a difference between being clever and being funny?
Oh, sure. There's a huge difference. Funny is what gets laughs. Clever is what makes you admire. It's quite different.
Well, going back to those rules, content dictates form, less is more, God is in the details, clarity. It sounds like something an architect might
Well, it is. I think less is more is attributed to Mies van der Rohe, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, is this something that you discovered as you were working?
You know, as I was working. And also, Hammerstein being sort of my mentor, and his language is mostly very plain or sometimes extremely overly poetic, but he certainly his lyrics are compact. Sometimes they're plain to the point of dullness. But there's no question that I'd say virtually every lyric he ever wrote is clear, except for where he muddled the meaning. But it's never they're always singable. His lyrics, that is to say, the tongue and the teeth can deal with most of them very well, particularly the later ones.
Well, you people assume, I'm sure, that he is one of your idols because he was your mentor.
Not an idol. A hero. He was a hero, not an idol.
But you can be critical. His cockeyed optimist is one of the cases, because the lyric there doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. When the sky is a bright canary yellow, first of all, I would challenge anybody to show me a bright canary yellow sky, but the only one I've ever heard of is In the Eye of a Hurricane. So mm-hmm. If the sky's a bright canary yellow, I suggest you run for the nearest storm shelter.
I've never really appreciated You'll Never Walk Alone.
Well, you know, that may be because you find it too sentimental as a mm-hmm. thought. You know,
and he sometimes did write really sentimental songs.
And he often ended his shows, particularly starting with Carousel, with a hymn-like or an anthem-like thought. But he believed them. He believed them. They're not fake.
You also critiqued the work of other much-loved lyricists, including Lawrence Hart, Ira Gershwin, Alan J. Lerner, Cole Porter.
No, I don't critique Cole Porter very much because I think he's pretty good. I mean, my assessment of the lyric writers, you know, certainly they're more negative about Noel Coward and Lawrence Hart and Ira Gershwin than they are positive. But they're much more positive about Cole Porter and Irving Berlin and Dorothy Fields and Frank Lesser. And Yaparberg than they are.
Why those rather?
Well, yeah, you have to go into each case. Yeah. You know,
because they're all much loved, other than Noel Coward, yeah. I think, who may be given more credit for being witty than he actually
well,
was.
Well, I think he's mostly given credit because he was so versatile. He did so many things well, and so he was so accomplished, and I think that's part of the admiration. In fact, I think that's the main reason for the admiration, although there are people who would claim that Private Lives is a great comedy. I wouldn't, but there are certainly people who do.
Alan J. Lerner, My Fair Lady.
Well, Alan, you see, I don't find those lyrics very interesting. I like A Hymn to Him, although the title is so coy, it always gives me the pip. But I think that's a really good lyric because that's both character and it's full of surprises. But an awful lot of the other ones are, I think, space-filling. I just don't find his lyrics very interesting, although I loved My Fair Lady as a show. I thought it was a wonderful show.
Well, you don't address – by the way, you do praise Dorothy Fields, one of my favorite lyricists.
Absolutely. She's great.
Just brilliant from beginning to end. And Frank Lesser.
Yep.
But you don't address the work of some of your contemporaries like Fred Ebb,
I don't talk about anybody who's alive, and those people are so recently – deceased, and they were friends, that I think it's too soon. If it was 20 years from now or 10 years from now, I would talk about them. But no, I...
Well, you were dying to write both the music and the lyrics, but you also seem to get great pleasure from the collaborative process.
I love collaboration. I've often been asked, you know, why don't I write my own books? Well, first of all, I think playwriting is, you know, the hardest of all the literary forms. And secondly, I just love having a family around. I grew up as an only child, and to have a collaborator and then a group of collaborators. First is the writing collaborator, which is like having a brother or a sister, or, you know, the sense of, or even a marriage. It's two against the world as opposed to one against the world. And then when the director hops aboard, and then eventually the actors, and and the design team and all that. It's a family. It's a family. I love that feeling, and I love collaboration. I'm a good collaborator.
Well, you've also collaborated with some pretty great artists. Mm-hmm. We mentioned Julie Stein, Jerry Robbins, Leonard Bernstein, Richard Rodgers, Hal Prince, James Lapine.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume that you got along better with Hal Prince and James Lapine because you did so many things with them and because a director plays a very different role.
No, they're very different. Hal and I were friends before we became collaborators. So that is a collaboration that grew partly out of friendship. And then we just found that we saw the theater in similar terms. And But Hal was not a writer. James is a writer and director, you know, and that's what distinguishes him. And I think most writers should not direct their own work, but I think James is the exception.
Throughout the book, you show pages of your notes as you worked on lyrics for all the shows. On some of them, you're clearly working on perfecting lines with lots of rhymes, adjectives, possible words to substitute. On others, the lyrics look to be almost the same as what ended up in the final production. Are there songs?
No, I think what you're looking at is the final sheets. There's never been a lyric that
you
I've ever written that
tinker.
Doesn't have at least 10 of those pages. Yeah, and in selecting the pages for the book, we try to select ones that would be fun to read and see the various choices, but also would be graphically readable, you know, and that sort of thing.
When you're going over them, are there early lyrics that you just think, wow, I really was hot?
Every now and then I read some lyrics. I think I read a lyric that I hadn't thought of in a long time. I thought, yeah, that's good.
Pretty Little Picture, for example.
Pretty Little Picture. But, you know, some of the lyrics from Gypsy I look at again. I think, gee, that's good. You know, some people, that's a good lyric.
Well, I tend to think that Gypsy comes as close to being the perfect musical.
Well, a lot of people feel like it's a perfect musical of a chronological conventional sort. I mean, it was the culmination of the so-called conventional the kind of musical that Oscar, I won't say pioneered. Yes, he pioneered. Why mince words? I think he pioneered it. But then, after that, comes time to start experimenting, start breaking the form apart or fooling around with it. But, no, as far as the so-called well-made musical, it has some flaws, but it's just so entertaining from minute to minute. It's like Citizen Kane, which is a movie always worth seeing because it's entertaining every single minute.
Mm-hmm. Well, every few years, it seems someone is writing about the death of the American musical theater. You say that it just had to end, the classic musical just had to end and something else had to follow. But are you happy with some of the things that have followed, the jukebox musicals?
No, the trouble, obviously, with most of the new musicals on Broadway is that they come from commercial instincts and not from writing instincts. There are exceptions, but most of the interesting stuff done is off-Broadway or in regional theater. Occasionally, a show will get enough notice that some producer will pick it up and bring it to the commercial theater, meaning Broadway. Shows like Rent and like Next to Normal and Spring Awakening. But they're few and far between. Producers having to spend so much money on a musical, they want either familiar songs where the audience comes into the theater humming the songs, and those are the so-called jukebox musicals, or they want the guarantee of a big star or a big reputation from London, or they'll take a chance on – not take a chance, but – what amounts to rock concerts for the theater, you know? When an audience, they think that when an audience feels comfortable knowing what they're going to get in a show, that's what they want. An audience going into Rock of Ages knows what it's going to get. Well, what this means is that there isn't much room left for writers to invent things that get produced on Broadway. And there's plenty of room to get produced off-Broadway and plenty of room to get produced in other cities and in regional theaters, but not on Broadway.
Well, in your case, it's led to a fair number of revivals.
Yes, that's
right. We have A Little Night Music on Broadway right now. Right, it's a hit again.
But don't forget when the first cast of the revival starred a movie star, Catherine Zeta-Jones. And, you know, stars have been the staple of the theater since the Greeks, but certainly since Shakespeare's day. Nobody went to see a Shakespeare play. They went to see Richard Warwick. And people who decry, as some columnists and critics do, decry the use of TV and movie stars in shows. Well, but that's exactly what draws audiences in. And they forget that in the days when theater was the only game in town, people would go see the Lunts. They wouldn't go to see a Robert Sherwood play. They went to see the Lunts in a Robert Sherwood play. And so they used to be stage stars. And then the television.
Well, we still have some of them. Bernadette Peters,
but she's virtually the last in line.
To some degree, Patti LuPone.
Yes, okay. I'll put both of those. But, I mean, they're both ladies of the same age. Mm-hmm. We're talking about women, you know, in late middle age.
And both in Gypsy at one point.
That's right. That's absolutely correct.
Well, so we've had A Little Night Music Company, Sweeney Todd, Assassin, Sunday in the Park with George, West Side Story, Gypsy, all revived, and hits. When you see them, do you ever think, gee, I'd love to be able to go back and tinker with
them? Oh, sure. I occasionally do. I changed a couple of lines in Sweeney Todd for the movie, and certainly Merrily We Roll Along is something George Firth and I worked on sporadically over a period of about 12 years after the show had closed on Broadway until we got it the way we wanted it. And now it's that. And Wise Guys, which became Bounce, which became Roadshow, same process till we got it the way we wanted it.
Follies is a musical of pastiches and to the golden age of vaudeville and musicals. How do you define the word pastiche?
The phrase I used was homage without attitude. Mm-hmm. It's not a takeoff. It's not a burlesque, but it is in a style, in a recognizable style, that I would hope somebody who'd never heard it before might think that if I'm imitating Cole Porter, that it was a Cole Porter song.
And was that the idea? I mean, was it fun thinking, I'm going to do Cole Porter now, I'm going to do Gershwin?
Absolutely. Now? Absolutely. It was great fun. And because I love all those guys. And imitating them was really fun, and both the lyrics and the music. Imitating was really fun.
You say that the first anniversary party for Fiddler on the Roof provided inspiration for that show's
plot. Forgot about that, yeah. No, it didn't provide inspiration. We'd written the show already. We'd written the first few drafts, but we were at the first anniversary of Fiddler party, and we're sitting out front, and the party was on the stage, and they were all eating and drinking on the stage, and the company manager looked furtively around and dropped part of his sandwich into the orchestra pit. Or maybe it was a sandwich paper, but he used the orchestra pit as a garbage pail because he couldn't find a garbage pail. And I said to James Goldman, my collaborator on the show, I said, there's our show. That's it. That image is exactly what our show's about, a group of people getting drunk on a stage at a reunion.
The song I'm Still Here is one of the show's best known. You wrote it after you discovered the vocal talents of Yvonne DiCarlo?
Well, I'd written another song. The point is that character, Carlotta, was a very, very minor character in James's script and mm-hmm. when we wrote it. And I'd written a short song for her called Can That Boy Foxtrot? And for that character. Then Hal decided to cast Yvonne DiCarlo, who was a very well-known person. And he said, you know, the audience is going to want to see more of her because I said, I understand. So I made.
We all knew she could dance because I saw her
in Salome where she danced.
Well, also in the Captain's Paradise.
Oh, right, that's right. Yes, of course she danced there. Of course she did. I don't know that she ever sang in movies. She probably did mm-hmm. because she made a lot of those harem movies and things like that. I'm sure she sang things, but I didn't know that she could sing. But she had a big voice, and so I made the mistake instead of writing a new song. Although there were so many songs to write for Follies, and in the last sort of rehearsal period that I didn't have a chance really to think about it. So what I did was I expanded Can That Boy Foxtrot to take advantage of the fact that Yvonne has three distinct voices, a top soprano, a middle register, and a low, almost contralto sound, and sort of like Ema Sumac's trick voice. So I thought I would take this and expand it so she could use each of the three voices as three different characters. It ended up as a 7-minute number and not very interesting. She did okay. And we opened with it in Boston, and it clearly was something that needed attention. And so James came up with the phrase, I'm Still Here, James Goldman. And so I wrote I'm Still Here, and she sang that instead.
Mm. And that was a showstopper.
And that was the right song.
I'm sure you're surprised when one show becomes a huge hit and another one, if not a flop, doesn't mm-hmm. get the same kind of success. Do you have a sense, or did they all are they all
no,
your children? They all
no,
feel
no. They all, you know, I like them all for different reasons. Except Do I Hear a Waltz, which I don't like particularly. But I shouldn't say I don't like it, but it's a show I think I wish I hadn't taken the time to write.
Could you fix it up?
No, it's not about fixing. It's about taking the time to write that particular show because that show was written not out of love but out of greed. We thought we could make a lot of money, and it's a very well written and very well put together show, and it's dead in the water, and it just has no life to it, and it just shouldn't have been written. But all the others I like for different reasons. No, you can't tell. Over a period of weeks, of course, you can tell whether a show is going to be a hit or a big hit. But in the old days, it used very much to depend on the newspaper opinions and then eventually on opinion just of the New York Times. Now I think it really is very much more word of mouth and advertising that does it.
But in the old days, you used to start a show out of town.
Oh, sure.
And so the taste of people in Baltimore or Philadelphia or Boston really had an impact.
No, I don't think so. I think actually, although Washington was known as a terrible out-of-town place and Boston as a very good one, but and New Haven is a good one and Philadelphia is a bad one. I mean, when the audiences in Philly and Washington were tougher, so to speak, less open, whereas the audiences in New Haven and Boston were more eager and happy generally. But essentially what you want to do is not so much gauge whether the audience liked it a lot as to whether it was clear. I think it's always, does the audience understand what's going on? Is there confusion? Because often, you know, when people get restless in an audience, it's not so much they're bored. They're bored because they don't understand what's going on. And if they understand what's going on, and that's what essentially you
because
you
they've
fix
come
a show.
Wanting to have a good time.
Well, that, and all, no, it's also, you said, I'm going to tell you this story. And then you better tell them the story. You know, it's the Pinero principle of tell them what you're going to do, do it, and then tell them that you've done it.
Just one more thing. A DVD of your 1966 television musical, Evening Primrose, was just released.
Yeah.
You don't write about it in this book. Was writing for TV very different from
it was different because you take advantage of the camera. The chapter on TV and movie songs is going to be in the second volume.
And this is a black and white version, even though it was in color.
Yeah, it was in color. Nobody's ever been able to find the original.
Although you've had a color copy of it?
No. The copy I got a long time ago was a black and white kinescope. It never occurred to me to get a color copy because these are the days before, you know, videotape recorders. I mean, this was film.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
the print is quite beautiful. So yeah, obviously they've done great work on it.
Yeah, well, they found, I think what they did was they found an unused negative or something like that, but not of the color. I can't remember what it is, but they found something and then struck it from that.
Stephen Sondheim, we've been talking about the music and lyrics he's written for many shows before 1981. We should also point out he's the co-author of the film The Last of Sheila and the play Getting Away with Murder. And he is the author of a new book called Finishing the Hat, Collected Lyrics 1954-1981, with attendant comments, principles, heresies, grudges, whines, and anecdotes. It's a beautiful, large-sized book, and it has been my great pleasure talking with you today.
Oh, Leonard, thank you very much. It's been fun to talk to you, too.
Being alive.